And this idea that we can build big things in Canada that are success stories, that are first of their kind stories. And so we use this image that you actually took, Francis, to also highlight this idea of ambition in Canada.
Francis here from Electricity Canada. Welcome to another episode of The Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. This is number 133, episode 133 of The Flux Capacitor. I've been chatting with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders. I've built this as an opportunity for you, the listener, to get a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector, in hallways over coffee, outside of parliamentary committees, in airport lounges, and at industry events. My guests, plural, on the podcast today are
Julia Muggeridge,
Chana Pereira,
Mike Powell.
The members of my executive leadership team, all three vice presidents here at Electricity Canada, joined me for a conversation about the 2026 State of the Canadian Electricity Industry Report on the eve of its release. We discuss the context of the report, the principal themes, including the challenges of getting projects built, to people, supply chains, financing, the integrated grid, resilience and security, and recommendations to address these challenges. We close the conversation with three book recommendations. Here is my conversation with Julia, Chana, and Michael, recorded on Zoom in late January 2026. Julia, Chana, Michael, welcome to the podcast. We're here to talk about our 2026 State of the Canadian Electricity Industry. And I want to have a conversation about what is in the report itself, essentially describes where we see the industry at this particular point in time, and what some of our prescriptions are and recommendations for the future prosperity of it. But I thought we'd start off with maybe let's chat a little bit about where we are at this particular point in time, how much things have changed, really, because this is an annual report. You three are the principal authors this year of the report. But, you know, when you were putting together the material for the report this year, did you reflect on, like, how much the world has changed broadly and how much our business has changed since this time last year? Maybe, Michael, why don't we kind of kick off with that from a political standpoint, right? We're in a very different place today than we were 12 months ago in Canada and North America.
Yeah. So I think if we were to have this conversation this time last year and project what the world might look like in 2026, I think that you would have a very different outcome. This time last year, we had no prime minister or prime minister on the way out. We had a president that was 2 days in to, you know, we weren't sure what that would look like. And we are here today with, well, the same president, a different prime minister than perhaps we would have thought of, and very different assumptions about how the world works than would have been the case last year. The prime minister was at Davos at the World Economic Forum last week, and had a speech which was unique in a lot of ways, and maybe the most unique was that the rest of the world actually paid attention to it, because it said that the world that we lived in is over and that middle powers like Canada have to work and band together. But it's funny, we talk about how the world has changed and some of the assumptions that we think about are different. But the prescription for our sector, and when we look back to when we first put a state of the industry together in my tenure here at Electricity Canada in 2019, we were talking about the urgency to get building and make it more straightforward to add energy and capacity to the electricity system. We have to struggle with affordability and to balancing the needs of growing the system with making it affordable. And you look 2-3 years later, we talked about the need to build it. And on a moment where it seems like we're at a global inflection point, we are here and saying, this is the moment and we don't have any time to lose. We didn't have time to lose before, but the urgency of movement is even more that if we have a desire to be an energy superpower, if we're going to make sure we can compete in a world where, as the Prime Minister said, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, then the solution to that is to make sure we have the energy we need to make sure that we can power and grow our economy. And if we're going to meet the needs of electricity growth, and we're going to do it affordably and reliably, we have to get building. We have to make sure that permitting is a process that's predictable and quick. We need to make sure that we have the financing tools that can make sure our members can get the approvals they need and then move stuff forward. We need to make sure we have the people and the things to build it. And then we need to keep it secure, whether it's physical or environmental or cyber threats. All those are things we have to do. And we can't look forward 7 years from now when some version of us are writing the same report and say, well, man, this time is the year because we don't have the world has changed around us. And so we have to change to meet the need. And I think that's what we're saying today.
Yeah. So we're going to unpack a lot of the things that you said and talk a little bit about some of the recommendations that we've had in this space. But we've seen a lot of change in the past year, but some of the fundamentals haven't changed at all, right? I mean, for example, and maybe Julia, you can comment a little bit about on this. The customer expectation hasn't changed. The customer is still critically important. Demand is increasing. We're still, you know, looking at a future where the demand for electricity really hasn't shifted that much. In fact, it might be even more so from our vantage point today than it was a year ago.
Yeah, it's more of the same with different leadership in Canada. In terms of customer satisfaction, we're actually doing really, really well. Post COVID, our customer satisfaction scores have gone up. And this is really good for our sector because when customers like their utility, it means that we have social permission to build. So we have customer satisfaction is actually increasing, which is great. Otherwise, it is a lot of the same with a new government that is more ambitious than the last in terms of building.
Yeah. And Chana, one of the other things that hasn't changed, and that I know you've been talking about for quite some time, it's been a significant issue, is with respect to regulatory, particularly rate regulatory. Michael talked about permitting, and we're going to jump into permitting. But just again, kind of level setting at the very beginning, one thing that hasn't changed and probably hasn't changed since, the early 1960s, is how rate regulation works. We've been talking about this for a long time, but that's still a significant outstanding issue, right?
Absolutely, Francis. Rate regulation continues to be a difficult issue to deal with. There are principles of rate regulation that hasn't changed, like you said, from the 1960s. But many of those principles can now be used in a way to advance innovation and the kinds of investments that we need to undertake. But the regulators are still concerned about the rate impact, the impact on the consumer. I think what we need to be thinking about is ensuring that customer affordability is at the center of policymaking, right? It shouldn't be an afterthought. Part of the challenge we have is we wait for the customers to push back and say, we want change. We cannot afford more investment and having to pay more for their basic energy needs. So I think the most central thing we need to understand in our rate making process is understanding the customer rate implications and ensuring that the policies are designed in a way to mitigate the impact on the rate payers.
Okay. And then the last thing from a level setting standpoint would be it's still with us as a significant issue and probably more acute. We're recording this on a day when we are all receiving notifications about extreme weather, an extreme weather event that's going to be blowing into the middle and the eastern part of North America really this weekend. So weather continues to be a significant challenge and a top of mind issue for everybody. Well, I thought maybe, next, let's talk a little bit about sort of the thematic approach to this, and Michael, you mentioned, you know, some of the things that we were focused on previously. But like Julia, when you were looking at what the theme should be this year, I thought it was interesting. You know, we've gone through a bit of an evolution, right? We went from build it in 2023 to getting to yes in 2024 to electricity is essential in 2025. So what's 2026?
Yeah, and maybe I'll quickly talk about electricity is essential, which was last year's report.
Yeah.
And the purpose of that report during such a tumultuous period in Canadian politics was just to remind the federal government that they can't forget about us. And so that report had a very different tone than this year's report. So it was gentle, it was educational, and it was just a reminder that electricity needs to be reliable and affordable for Canadian customers. This report and the tone is a lot more ambitious, and we use the word ambitious in the introduction to describe and try to connect the dots between our sector and the federal government. And there's something we heard a good panel, all of us collectively at our Powering Partnerships event. And David Lebeter actually said, what happened to ambition? Like, this is the time that we really have to build. And always with the frame or under the context of affordability. So we wanted to highlight in this year's theme that you have to balance ambition with affordability. And we also used a trip that all of us also went on with our board of directors to the Robert Bourassa Dam. And there was a moment back in June where we were looking at this dam. And I think all of us were just blown away by the size and scale and magnitude of this dam. And this idea that we can build big things in Canada that are success stories, that are first of their kind stories. And so we use this image that you actually took, Francis, to also highlight this idea of ambition in Canada. The title, Forging Canada's Electricity System, just gets down to that gritty need to build now. Almost like Lord of the Rings type, like that was the imagery that we used throughout this report.
Right.
It's feet on the ground, and we'll talk a little bit more about supply chain shortly, but it's labor, it's having the materials and putting all of that together to help deliver on this ambition. So I think that set the tone for like a much more ambitious state of the industry than last year when we were just whispering, electricity is important, don't forget. And this year we're like, hey, you didn't forget. Here we are. And here are some very strong recommendations to set your government up for success.
Okay, well, let's jump into some of those recommendations. And maybe, you know, the first area of focus, and it kind of, you know, reflects back on some of the previous themes. Build It, for example, in 2023 is our theme in that year. The report talks about the complexity of actually getting projects built. I know there's a case study in there with respect to Yukon Energy, but maybe Michael, can you drill down a little bit for the listener about really how complex is it to get projects built? And then maybe we can touch on some of the recommendations that we have in this area.
I mean, it's very complex. And I think that's part of the challenge. And some of this is logical, right? Like if you are building a hydro facility that is going to dam a river, then obviously there's a lot of work and engineering and planning that goes into it. A nuclear plant is literally a nuclear plant. It's one of the most complicated machines that people have ever invented. The challenge we get into is when we start thinking about the processes that the federal government and provincial governments have to work through to approve these things. And they are duplicative sometimes between different levels of government. They sometimes have unclear routes and processes. It's not always clear that the outcomes of effort are aligned with the risk or need. And so what you have is a reputation for Canada where it's very difficult to build big projects and that what you add is risk and complexity to already complicated projects. So that you don't have to worry just about the technical risk of building something that's first in kind or you know, whether there will be some other thing outside of your control that may impact the success or timeliness of a project. These are all things that are firmly in government's hands that can take an unpredictable amount of time, which has a cascading impact on how you move projects forward. And that is for projects that will that you know add time and delays. It adds cost when you think about acquiring more materials. And in some cases, it means maybe you will just invest somewhere else where it's a little clearer. We've been pushing for a long time to have one project, one approval, and firm timelines. We're very happy, I think, that this government has committed to a 2-year timeline for all projects, starting with projects to the projects of national interest
Those
that are brought
the
to the
ponies that the ponies that are
Is that what we're calling them?
project of national interest, a pony,
Well,
the
everyone the challenge is that
C5,
everyone wants a pony, but not everyone can have one.
right.
And so what we are seeing here with the Major Projects Office, which was just launched with actually one of our former board members as a chair, is that there are a handful of projects that are moving forward, and that's all well and good, but how do we extend that same effort to other pieces? And I think the challenge for government as we look forward is how do we make sure that the regular things, not just the ponies that all of us are looking for and that aspire to have, are able to advance? Because if you look at it, just it's not just big projects that have an impact on risk and challenge, but if you have 100 small projects that take a little longer or a little more expensive because of extra effort from a duplicated regulation, it all ends up on the same bill and has the same piece. And so what we're pushing for is get firm on that 2-year timeline by finding ways of reducing red tape, advancing some of the stuff the government's already doing, aligning better with provincial governments for some of their processes, and really taking a look at longstanding practice as longstanding irritants that we've identified. So things like changing the Fisheries Act so that it looks more at fish populations and not just individual fish, so that we can operate the hydro facilities we have, making sure that we have clear rules for engaging with communities as we build things, and then just really setting a shot clock to make sure that government is holding itself accountable for advancing projects through. It should be on government to make sure that our members are the ones that are moving as fast as we can, and not just moving at the speed of government should be a thing which is not like a criticism of being slow, but of being just as fast as it can be. The case study you mentioned is actually a really important one because it's not just about building new things, it's about how we can maintain and operate the assets that we already have. And so we look at the situation in Yukon where there are it's Yukon is actually a wonderful case study for a lot of the challenges of Canada's broader grid. It's a territory, it's a relatively small system, it's on its own, but it's seeing extreme growth in load. It is has challenges with ha not having enough power. It operates hydro facilities. They actually were tight on power over the Christmas break because of high demand and low temperatures, and so they're seeing it all. And in this particular case, for our case study, is three dams provide 90% of the renewable energy that the territory uses, and they've had to relicense. And these are dams that have existed for decades. We have a very good sense of where the impacts are in terms of fish population, in terms of water management, and the process of getting them relicensed for a facility that has existed for decades was onerous and challenging. It required extra work and labor from staff, and all of that for something that has existed before and will exist again in the future. And so, why are we spending staff, time, and effort to focus on keeping these sorts of things, which won't change the outcome for the environment at all, but does take away from our ability to focus on other things to build a system and move forward? And I think that if that's true in a territory of, what, 40,000 people, 50,000 people, that's true across the country as well. And I think that that's where we have to remember on these things.
Channing, you wanted to chime in?
Yeah, as we look at major projects and those big investments, I think one of the most important things we should be thinking about is Indigenous buy-in, Indigenous engagement. A lot of the times, I think there is a paradox where companies spend lots of money in terms of engineering studies, financial plans, and so forth. But we tend to spend just a fraction of that in terms of Indigenous engagement and building relationships. We need to ensure that as we move forward, if we want to build these projects within a very short timeline of, say, 1 to 2 years, we need to ensure that we get Indigenous buy-in and we engage those communities early on. And without that engagement, it'll be very difficult to meet 1 to 2 year timeline to get these projects off the ground and getting approved.
And but I mean you worked directly with one of our committees in this space. You've seen, I'm sure, over the last decade, a pretty significant change in terms of how the sector's approaching this, right? Nowadays, I don't know of any project that isn't moving forward without some kind of a partnership approach, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we have come a long way over the last 10 years, for sure,
Yeah.
in terms of Indigenous partnerships. One of the main things that member companies are looking at is equity partnerships. And a lot of the communities are interested in that. There are other forms of revenue sharing that companies can look at. And we, our member companies, have been doing that. But I just want to reiterate the importance of continuing to do that and engaging those communities in conversations about what is of value to them, how they can be partners with us, and looking at long-term sustainability. And we need to make sure that once the project is complete, that there is a stream of revenue for those communities so so that they can continue to prosper over years to come.
Okay. So when we talk about the projects that are going to be required to be able to meet the energy demands, the electricity demands in the future, we're going to require we're going to have to build a sort of system capacity. In the report, we talk about both materials and we talk about people. While Channa, while you're, you know, you've while you've got the while you've got the conch right now, talk a little bit about people. You know, what are the what's the people challenge that we're facing, and how we're going to address that?
When it comes to people, we have a significant challenge. We are not the only country in the world looking at investing in the energy transition or clean energy or addressing climate change. All of the major economies are looking at the same issue, and we are fighting for the same people, the same skill set, and the same material. So we have a lot of work to do. And for example, Electricity Human Resources Canada did a recent study which said we need to hire 28,000 new workers to replace and to meet expansion needs by 2028. That's just 2 years away. And that is one fourth of our current workforce. So that is a lot of people. But then if you look at some of the other plans in play with companies like Hydro-Quebec, major investment plan over the next 5 years, and they will require around 32,000 construction workers. So it is not just the 28, but the 30,000 right there in the province of Quebec. And so one of the things that we need to do is to ensure that there is alignment in terms of workforce strategy and industrial policy. They cannot be on different tracks. We need alignment on that and ensure that we continue to invest in workforce training, awareness about careers in the energy sector. We need to be providing more co-op internship opportunities for young people, and also labor mobility. We need to make sure that there is a credential recognition across the country.
And I noticed one of the things in the report was the recommendation that we establish a federal industry workforce advisory council.
That is important in terms of bringing all of the key players together. Right now, the collaboration is not at the level that we need in terms of labor market needs, identification data, ensuring that our curriculums are up to date, that we have partnerships between industry and academia so that what students learn in universities and colleges is consistent with what industry needs. So there's a lot of work to be done and can be done if we are intentional about some of those measures.
And it's not just people, it's also supply chains, right? Michael, I know you and members of your team have been talking about a supply. It feels like we've been talking about supply chains since the beginning of COVID. But what's the sort of the state of play, and what's our future going to look like with respect to trying to sort out supply chain challenges?
I think there's challenge and opportunity here too, right? I think one of the As the world looks to add more electricity capacity, the stuff to make electricity is in higher demand, and it's a lagging indicator for producing some of these things. So, one of the things we've talked about on an ongoing basis was the timeline it takes to get a large transformer, which could be 4 years. It could be up to 7 years for a gas turbine, and it moves on and on. So, and that's over and above challenges that you may see for access for even more routine things. So electrical steel, transmission towers, et cetera. And so how do we make sure that we are building out the network of materials so that we can have them when we need to get building? So for as a solution, some of the stuff we can do is what I talked about earlier. How can we, you can plan around longer timelines if you can have a pretty good idea when your approvals are going to come. So as you firm up the approval process federally, you can start working backwards and then making and putting your orders in earlier. But the world is changing as well. So data center demand and other low growth pieces like that are gobbling up all of the transformers and turbines, et cetera. But what is the opportunity for Canada? So we're spending hundreds of, we'll be spending $2 trillion potentially over the next 25 years to replace and expand the electricity system. And that's a real opportunity to think about how we can grow a manufacturing ecosystem in Canada so that we can make ourselves, we can supply ourselves and have some of that energy security, but also see the export opportunity from there as well. So just as the government of Canada is thinking about leveraging defense spending to grow that part of the economy, I think there's a real opportunity to build on the electricity industrial base that we already have. And can we talk about a case study with Northern Transformer and one of our members, Hydro One, that we've seen others of our corporate partners look to expand in the past few years, where they identify opportunities where there's a need in Canada and the ability to build forward. And our members that have medium-term plans, like Hydro-Québec with their Action Plan 2035, supply chain, and as Chana said, people are some of the limiting factors for them moving forward. So what's the solution in the near term? More predictable timelines will help us plan around it. But I think there's a real opportunity for there to be, we've suggested a Canadian electricity supply chain roadmap. So our members who can help identify projected demand, industry on the manufacturer side who can help, and then a variety of government programs. So ITCs, Growth Fund, the EDC and BDC to work together to figure out how we can build the business case and the investing case to start meeting our own internal needs in Canada, creating new jobs, and then maybe finding export opportunities in the future as well.
Let's follow up on that. You mentioned the need to invest overall, investment in the system, investment tax credits. We finally seen some movement in this space, something that we've been looking for a couple of years. Where are we now with investment tax credits? And are we done? Can we say, great, we've got a clean electricity ITC, and we can step back and
Well,
say we've got everything we need, and now we're just going to plow forward?
it's been introduced. I think that that's a welcome change. It's funny, Francis, you and I had a conversation with then Minister Guilbeault in what, 2023, when these things were first announced, and there was an urgency to respond to the Biden-era Inflation Reduction Act, which had introduced some of these pieces. And we are 3 years later, and the clean electricity ITC, which is the investment tax credit that will apply to the largest electricity operator in 7 of 10 Canadian provinces, if not 8 of 10, and the only one that can do anything with regards to wires for international, interprovincial transmission, the only one that does upgrades, the only one that for Crown corporations, hasn't been passed into law yet. And so it's been introduced. I think it'll be good to see when that's coming through. But we got to keep moving. And I think there's looking at it, we can see how we can make those easier to use by simplifying them, removing some of the complications that have been added on things like labor requirements and prevailing wages, which add a complexity and a compliance burden, which don't necessarily create more jobs. And then looking to make sure that they work in the long term, so extending them past 2035. The build out that we are going to have, it's a project that's starting today, like the new nuclear projects, large nuclear that Ontario is envisioning, probably won't get starting working until after the ITC is phased out. So let's extend them so that we can do it. And then we have to look at the other financing parts too. So making sure there's low-cost loans, changing the tax rules, like the interest deductibility limit changes that the EIFEL provisions, which make it harder for our members to invest, and they'll have to pass on tax debt to or tax costs to customers, and really focusing on an investment climate that has the financial tools that are there to help support the build out, so it's not just on the ratepayer, and also creates the investment climate that encourages companies to put dollars in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Jenna?
Yeah, just to build on what Michael said, Francis, we know that capital goes where it is welcome, right? For far too long, I think, in Canada, that didn't happen, right? We had climate policies that I think went too far and too fast and beyond what technology could have delivered. And so government over the last many years had quite a few punitive type measures, right? Targets and companies had to commit to meeting them. So I think there has been a good change over the last year. As we started this conversation, we talked about the changes that happened this time last year. And so a lot of positives. And the government did introduce a budget a couple of months ago in terms of unlocking nearly $500 billion. In new private investment. So I think what has happened is that with the recalibration of climate policy, we are in a position today to attract more private capital to invest in new infrastructure. And that's something that we can be happy about in terms of where things are going. But a lot of work still needs to be done in terms of ensuring that the regulatory requirements are not unclear, right? So we need to make sure that the rules are clear, unambiguous, so the private investors can invest in the projects that we want to move ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then among the investments that we're going to be expecting in the future we kind of move into this in the report when we talk about grid and grid investments and the integrated Canadian electricity grid. There's been a lot of talk about the east-west grid and increasing our interconnections between provinces, as opposed to what essentially has been, principally north-south up until now. Julia, you've been working with one of our board committees and working with external consultants to take a look at interties and what potential opportunities there are in this space. What are the kinds of things that you've been finding when looking at this? And then maybe we can chat a little bit about, what can we do to spur, if we want to spur more in this space?
Yeah, thanks, Francis. The East-West electricity system, we decided it should be a focal point within this year's State of the Industry. Back in April, when Mark Carney included it as one of his platform promises, it wasn't new to us. Like meetings that we've been in over the last number of years, it's often a question that politicians may ask, like, what about more East-West connections or an East-West corridor? But this was the first time that it got like national visibility in a political platform. And since then, I know that Michael's team has heard from NRCan looking for advice on how to move forward. Mm. And so we decided to use this state of the industry to our advantage to help redefine an east-west electricity system. I guess, firstly, just focusing on electricity system rather than electricity grid, because we wanted to make sure that when the government's thinking about the system, they're thinking about the demand side, that they're thinking about generation. Like, is there energy to flow between provinces at all? So we wanted to, first of all, like really set the stage for the system as opposed to the grid. Mm. The other thing we wanted to do was rethink the map. Like basically an electron can move across Canada from east to west. There are connection points between all of our provinces, but we wanted to emphasize that a lot of those connection points need to be enhanced. Mm. So we engaged with Deloitte over the last couple of months, and we've highlighted some of their findings in our report. And we've looked at current utilization rates of some of the existing interties in Canada. And we've found that if the government wants some quick wins now, there are opportunities for them to look at some of those existing east-west connection points. We highlight those opportunities in the report. And then we also look at some of the future scenarios. So we look at some of the demand predictions that have been presented both by the Canada Energy Regulator as well as different provincial predictions. And we've noted that already out to 2040, a lot of our provinces are going to be strained. The demand for electricity is increasing. Without stressing the system at all, I think there are only two or three provinces that are actually going to be fine. But if we add any sort of stress on our system, either through extreme weather events, whether our intermittent resources are up and running, then next thing you know, every single province in Canada is going to be stressed. So what we've offered in this analysis is that in 2040, if we're not looking at interties as an opportunity to add reliability for provinces, all of our provinces are going to be stressed.
Right.
So the report is, the Deloitte report that I'm speaking about is now available on our website for review in detail, but we've highlighted a lot of these opportunities and some of these stressors within the state of the industry, as well as some recommendations for things that the federal government can be thinking about when they think about their east-west electricity system and that campaign promise from back in April.
Mm-hmm. So this is kind of relates as well to podcast 131, two podcasts ago, when Jim Robb from NERC joined me, and we discussed the impending release of the long-term reliability assessment. We're recording this before the release. The release is going to be in a couple of days. But the heads up that we got from Jim was precisely what you indicated, that particularly in events of extreme weather, there are, and he was talking about it from a North American context, multiple jurisdictions all around North America that will be facing significant stress to be able to meet demand in the not too distant future. So this is, it sounds as though this is entirely consistent with the work that NERC has done as well.
Yeah. And I know you also just had Alan Danroth from Manitoba Hydro on the podcast.
Yep.
And Manitoba is actually a really good example of a province that has really looked to ensure they have a reliable system through current connections. But most of their current connections are north-south. They're part of MISO, which means that they are already heavily integrated with the United States. So Manitoba was one of our featured provinces for like a real opportunity for a connection point with Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan is exploring all sorts of new generation opportunities. And if Manitoba can take advantage of some of those, I think that both provinces will be better off.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the listener can go and take a look in the report on the map. You mentioned Manitoba in particular, where the interconnections with neighboring provinces are measured in the hundreds of megawatts and the low hundreds of megawatts, whereas the interconnection to the United States is in the thousands.
Yeah, and that's a relationship that obviously continues to be really important with Manitoba. So while we look at some of these opportunities for enhanced reliability from an east-west perspective, we also know that these neighboring relationships are really important to our members. We're seeing a lot of electricity being traded to the south. We talk a little bit about how this kind of came to be in the last 100 years in the report, because we thought it was important to look back, like why are we doing so much electricity trade with the south as opposed to east-west? So we talk a little bit about that, but I think we want to honor those relationships and recognize that like these are long-term contracts that our members are in, but then also look to some of those enhanced opportunities for those east-west connections.
Okay. Now, at the top of our conversation, one of the things that I mentioned that had not changed, given that all of the other things that have changed in the past year, was a concern about and a focus on climate, the changing climate. And we have a specific section in the report that's talking about wildfires and system protection. So what is, and I know there's the case study there with specifically with respect to Alberta, but Chana, can you talk a little bit about these challenges in the wildfire space and what it is that we need to be doing to address it in the future?
Yeah, for sure. Now, exposure to wildfire, or if you take extreme weather in general, I think has become a really significant issue for the electricity sector. And Francis, one of the things is it is no longer sporadic, right? Wildfire is now, or all of the other types of extreme weather, is more systemic. And that's really important. We see a more frequent, more intense events are taking place, whether it's the heat wave,
Sure.
droughts, wildfires, ice storms, windstorms, tornadoes, you name it, right? And
Or in the case of where our office is located in Ottawa, we had two 100-year floods 3 years apart, right?
exactly. Exactly. So just to provide some context, if you look at the last 3 years, almost every province and territory has been affected because of wildfire, and especially BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Quebec, and Northwest Territories. And then in 2023 alone, we saw over 5,000 wildfires that impacted over 17 million hectares of forest cover, right? To put it in context, that is bigger than Greece, right? That kind of land being impacted by forest fires. And again, in 2025, we had a similar situation where over 3,500 forest fires alone in Canada. And to put it in context, in 2025, the land impacted was around 6.26 million, four times the 10-year average of 1.38 million hectares burned, right? So again, it is a really significant issue. And if you were to look at electricity specifically, and look at power poles. If you were to replace just one pole, it's going to cost $3,000 to $6,000 Canadian, depending again on the height of the pole, the equipment on the pole, and so forth. So that is a substantive amount that the utilities will have to invest in when these things happen.
That the customer and will the cost to the customer the will customer, ultimately pay for. Yeah,
absolutely. And also there are other factors too. I mean, forest fires can jeopardize public safety, communities, and other equipment as well. So again, this is an issue where the regulators will have to look at, and the governments as well, in terms of providing financial support or some kind of tax credit to ensure that we can invest in infrastructure and weather harden the infrastructure we have at the moment.
Now, the last topic that I wanted to touch on, and there is a brief chapter on this on the report. Michael, I spent 20 years doing our security work, working with our Security and Infrastructure Protection Committee. It also became an academic pursuit of mine as well, partway through that. But you've been responsible at the executive level now for our security activities for the last several years. The world is changing. It continues to change. It continues to evolve. What's the state of play right now with respect to kind of protecting our electricity infrastructure in an ever more challenging digital age?
Well, I think we're in ever more dangerous times, and our members have been shields up now for 4 or 5 years, and it looks like the world ahead of us is going to be even more uncertain. The government of Canada has identified threats to critical infrastructure, but specifically the electricity sector, as being a major cyber risk for a half dozen years now, and we knew about it before then. And this is specific and actionable, and it's from criminal groups that might be trying to steal money or information and sell it. And it's also from nation states. It's our enemies are thinking about how they can disrupt the power system, and there are real concerns around what that might mean in the event of a future conflict. I was actually down in Washington this past week working with our colleagues both in the United States and in Canada, and with industry, thinking about how we can better harden the grid with for operating technologies. And so this isn't theoretical. Our members have experienced disruptions in the past year on the information technology side, but there is a risk, of course, for how we keep the system safe. So what are we doing? Part of it is constant vigilance and always looking to share information and work as closely as we can with the government of Canada and our partners on the other side of the border and in other industries to make sure that we are as prepared as possible But also thinking about what resilience looks like. It is when an event happens, because something will happen at some point, how do we make sure that we are able to respond and keep the system operating or get the system back operating and keep people safe and secure? Because the reason that electricity is essential, I mean, it's the most important critical infrastructure. It powers the lights, it makes sure that we have water, it keeps us safe and move and warm. And we have to make sure that we're ready to restore it whenever we can.
Great. Okay. Well, listen, I think that kind of gives the listener a pretty good overview of the report broadly. Now, what, Julia, you know, you've been central to these reports over the years. Again, for the listener, like, what do you do with this report? So we've got a report. It's on our website. We hand it out at meetings. But you know, what is this as a tool for the association and for the sector?
Yep. So it will formally be released on Tuesday, January 27th, and we're going to release it to a government audience. I think the focus of the report has always been government
policy, and so a real policy focus. Yeah.
There's a real policy focus. Like we've tried to change the tone over years just to reflect, like, even where we launch it. We've launched it at GLOW. We've launched it to deputy ministers. Mm-hmm. This one is really weedy. It draws on real data that we've worked hard over the last couple of months to collect, and it offers real recommendations. So we're making sure that this is getting launched to the right audience, which is a number of deputy ministers. We're going to go to the parliamentary press gallery and you're going to make a speech about it. And we're going to do a bunch of ads as well. And then we'll use it over the next couple of months to inform our different meetings, to keep the pedal to the metal on a lot of these recommendations. Mm. And I think an important thing to add is that this state of the industry, I would say, is pretty fluid for about 6 months, because we may hear things in these meetings that, you know, allow us to maybe add more content to a recommendation. So mm-hmm. we do small print runs because we always anticipate that there may be throughout the year an opportunity to enhance this. We know that there may be a spring economic statement. Is there a way to enhance our report in advance of that? Mm-hmm. Is there a way to use this report to bolster our pre-budget submission?
Right.
So it's really a year-long report that we stopped talking about probably around October. But until then, we're like, hey, did you grab a copy of the state of the industry as you're leaving our event, as you're going into a meeting?
Right.
And Francis, gotcha. This is extra timely because the government of Canada is working on an updated electricity strategy mm-hmm. that Natural Resources Canada, the Prime Minister's Office, Environment Canada, we've been engaging with. And we know that's in the works. We're not sure what's in it. But the point of these sorts of conversations is this is what we think a successful electricity strategy would look like, mm-hmm. that it has these sorts of parts that help us and our members move forward with building more electricity, adding capacity, making sure that it doesn't break people's bills, and that we keep it safe and secure. And so as we look to whatever comes from that, we'll look to, on the advocacy side, working with our members, make sure that whatever the government puts out integrates these sorts of pieces so that we can work together to build the electricity system that Canada needs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. With that, we'll get to my customary wrap-up of the podcast. And that's for a book recommendation. And so we'll go around the call and get a book recommendation from each and every one of you. And we will go reverse alphabetic order and start with you, Michael. What would be your book recommendation for the listener? What are we going to add to the...
I just finished a book called Everything is Tuberculosis by a guy named John Green. You probably know him as a children's author, but he actually hosted maybe my favorite podcast ever, which is called The Anthropocene Reviewed. And he's a YouTuber that gets into like knowing things. But the book looks at the history of tuberculosis, both over time and how it impacted culture. And it looks at it through the frame of a relationship he built with a tuberculosis hospital and a young man that lived there in Sierra Leone. And the key thing, people probably forget about this in the global north, we don't think a lot about tuberculosis, but it kills more than 1 million people a year. And it's preventable. It's treatable. There's a vaccine. And it ends with the thesis that It's people don't get tuberculosis. People don't die of tuberculosis. They die of a bad social policy. And so it's a quick read, but talks a lot about things we know and maybe things we can keep fixing.
All right. Okay, how about you, Chana?
Yeah, so we talked about major projects and Indigenous engagement. So I decided that perhaps my book recommendation is going to be related to Indigenous engagement.
Okay.
The book is called Indigenous Relations: Insights, Tips, and Suggestions to Make Reconciliation a Reality. The book was written by Bob Joseph with Cynthia Joseph. This is the book. And highly recommended. It provides some practical tips in terms of engaging in Indigenous communities and getting their buy-in.
All right. And Julia.
Yeah, I was hoping that they wouldn't give any fiction books so that I could be like the fiction book recommendation. I'm currently reading a book called Intermezzo. It's by Sally Rooney. She also wrote Normal People, which was turned into my favorite TV show ever. And the book is about a chess master. It's very interesting. She writes in a very disjointed way, so it takes a while to get used to her style, but she's a great author and a great storyteller. So
So what's the book?
it's called Intermezzo.
Intermezzo, and the author is
Sally Rooney.
Sally Rooney. Okay. So we've got Intermezzo by Sally Rooney. We've got Indigenous Relations by Bob Joseph. And we've got Everything Is Tuberculosis by John Green. What an interesting collection of books. Julia, Chana, Michael, I want to thank you for taking the time to jump on a podcast on a Friday afternoon to chat about our state of the electricity industry in Canada.
Thank
Thank
you.
you for having us.
Thank you.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen and let me know what you think of the flux capacitor. You can find me on Instagram as the Brad Bradley, on LinkedIn, and through our website at electricity.ca. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca and includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 133. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including today's three recommendations: John Green's Everything is Tuberculosis, Bob and Cynthia Joseph's Indigenous Relations, and Intermezzo by Sally Rooney. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.